session number 17394, reel 3.
Admiral Garrett's reel 3.
The following year, when I was in Scotland serving on the staff of the Senior Officer Assault Ships and Craft, 1941, I was responsible for training various battalions, and amongst them was 1st Guards Brigade with 2nd Coldstream, by this time commanded by Lieutenant Colonel R.C. Hill. So I renewed acquaintance with him and with a number of others. Thereafter, there was a complete interval. I went off to Madagascar. They went off in due course to North Africa and distinguished themselves at both the Coldstream Battalion and the Hampshire Battalion during North African campaign. And in fact, the Hampshire Battalion, with which I lived for a month in 1940, particularly distinguished themselves in the Battle of Tobruk when they won one of their Victoria Crosses by Major Le Patrol. And my old school friend, Major Cecil Thomas, also distinguished himself. However, I now emphasize there was an interval which lasted until the summer of 1944, when I was out of hospital and waiting to have my head repaired. And I was talking to my mother, and she suggested that she might rent her house and go and take a holiday in Scotland with some relations. No mention of this had been made outside the family, and suddenly a telephone call came, and it was one of our friends who rang up to say that she knew of a couple who wanted to rent a house in Cheltenham, and she started to give a description of them. And I said out of the blue, "This isn't a chap called Colonel Hill, is it?" And it was. It was none other than Colonel R.C. Hill and his wife, and they actually rented our house. Colonel Hill died 2 or 3 years ago. He was Lord Lieutenant of Powys.
Central Wales. Or North Wales. Part of Wales,
he was Lord Lieutenant of one of the counties in Wales, but it provides a curious continuity. And finally, to round that off, on my last day in naval uniform, when I was retiring, I had been invited to give the address at the Remembrance Day service in Salisbury Cathedral, and I did so. And this was the last time I appeared in uniform. And the bishop in charge of the diocese at that time was Bishop Victor Pike, who was acting as bishop in the absence of the diocesan, as there was an interregnum. So it completed the cycle of Victor Pike and my military service.
So, you were talking about going into combined operations.
Yes.
This is the summer of 1941.
I joined a ship called the Winchester Castle at Inverary. On a Saturday afternoon, and so Sunday morning was my first day, and it is a lovely bright day as it can be up on Loch Fyne, and the loch had a number of ships, the anchor, and a great number of small craft exercising to and fro. And this is my introduction to command operations. I was subsequently sent as the title is Senior Naval Officer Transport, but in fact a number of us were first of all sent to ships carrying motor transport. So there was Iwan had very few troops, but one was concerned to advise the master on the naval orders that might be issued for a particular operation. I have a copy of the orders for senior naval officers transport, which I can offer to the archive if that would be appropriate.
Thank you.
It would be interesting to know if anybody thought to ask for this at the time of the Falklands War. My impression is that with the customary military amnesia, nobody thought that this might have happened before. But you'll remember that Captain Byrne was the captain, I think, of the was the senior naval officer in Canberra, and I suspect they hadn't any orders. So I served in two motor transport ships, that is, carrying vehicles, military equipment. We had one frightening experience. We had to go to Scarpa Flow by night, and for ships' companies not accustomed to going in and out of Scarpa, and I certainly wasn't, it's pretty unpleasant when there's a strong wind blowing and visibility is not very good. But we could see the gate quite plainly. We were rather surprised to see the ship ahead of us go to starboard of the gate. And so as we got up to the gate, the captain said, "What should I do?" I said, "Well, just go on. You can't do anything." So on we went. Unfortunately, at that moment, the ship that had gone to starboard came astern and gave us a smart clout in the fore part of the ship, which sent us across the gate, so that we found ourselves leaning on the gate ship, which is rather surprised crew looking up at us. We then went on and anchored in the flow, and in the morning inspected the damage, which wasn't too serious, but there was a depth charge from the other ship, as far as I remember, lying on our upper deck, which, as there was case petrol there, wasn't a very good combination. Anyway, the point of this story really is the very large exercise that was conducted at Scarpa Flow at this time, which was witnessed by His Majesty the King and the Director of Combined Operations, who was Admiral Sir Roger Keyes. And the exercise was a classic catastrophic fiasco, and there were a lot of vehicles drowned, that is, driven off their landing craft too early, so that they fell into water that was deeper than their waterproofing would cope with, and the exercise was not a success. We had a wash-up on board the Winchester Castle, which included a talk by a wing commander who was pretty forthright. Some very stringent comments from Commodore Warren, who was the senior naval officer landing, as it was called, SNOL, about our incompetence, and a very severe lecture from Lieutenant General the Honourable HRLG Alexander, later Field Marshal, who gave us 6 weeks to get ourselves together. And then Admiral Keyes spoke, and this revered figure with gold up to his shoulders and medals down to his waist gave a rather gloomy talk, in which he seemed to say that all the combined operations he'd taken part in had been failures, and this was no exception. Well, fortunately, he was relieved shortly afterwards, and Lord Mountbatten took on, and combined operations, as you realise, developed and developed until we were able to carry out the enormous operation in Normandy. Thereafter, I spent a month doing training at a camp at Inverkip, which was a form of beach training for beach parties. And then I joined the hard transport Ettrick at Loch Fyne, where we trained one battalion on board and one battalion ashore per week, using the 7 flotillas of landing craft which we had attached to the ship. The weather in the autumn in Scotland was obviously not the best, and we had many trials and tribulations in trying to get through a hectic program. But it was very stimulating, and one greatly enjoyed meeting a lot of soldiers and seeing a lot of landing craft crews developing their skills in navigation in the most difficult circumstances, because so much was going to depend on a lot of very young officers and ratings, most of them inexperienced in seamanship, but sprinkled with a considerable number of fine yachtsmen who provided some of our more senior flotilla officers. Anyway, after a rather exhausting time, I was summoned back to the headquarters at Largs, and I then worked from the headquarters at Largs under Admiral Warren until suddenly there was a call while the principal beachmaster, Lieutenant Bailey, was away. There was a call for a beachmaster, and I was with a group that went to London, and I found myself planning the invasion of Madagascar. We were in fact bringing up to date the plans that had been made at the latter part of 1941, when it was first realized that if the Japanese continued to advance at the rate they'd been going, they could well be across our communications with North Africa by getting a foothold in Madagascar, which was being held by the Vichy French. The operation in January 1942 had been postponed or held over, and this was a renewal of that same operation, which was codenamed Ironclad, and we duly sailed in late March. And the striking thing about this operation is the similarity between this operation and the one conducted off the Falkland Islands in 1982, 40 years apart. Both operations conducted at very long ranges from the United Kingdom. We did have the opportunity of doing some reloading and giving our troops some exercise in Durban, which wasn't the good fortune of the Falklands force. They had to cross deck, as it's called, at Ascension, that they had no opportunities for exercise beyond what could be done on the decks of ships. Anyway, we the things to remember are that the assault brigade was loaded with about 1,000 plus per ship. The next brigade, which was in the convoy, was 17th Brigade, was loaded in about 2,000 men per ship. And the 3rd Brigade, which was strictly speaking only on passage, it was brought into the operational force quite at the last minute. 13th Brigade, they were in the Franconia, all 4,000 plus. And I remember meeting in Salisbury many years later men who had served in the Royal Berkshire Regiment and actually been on board the Franconia, and they were able to confirm that the conditions were extremely unpleasant. The number of casualties from heat stroke, problems with feet and muscular difficulties, was of course in direct proportion to the number of troops that were on board, so that the Franconia's team had a very bad time when they had to come ashore having had a minimum of exercise. But our troops were able to march around the deck every day. And I must say, those ships that had bagpipes on board did get somewhat tired of the sound of the pipes, but that helped to keep the movement of troops on a good sound footing. The operation was commanded by a Royal Marine General, the Land Force Major General Sturgis, we made a night approach to the coast of Madagascar through very difficult navigational channels, and we attacked from the rear, as it were, of the port of Diego Suarez, which is the French naval, where the situation of the French naval base of Antsirani. Compare that with the approach to San Carlos in the Falklands at the end of a long voyage. And we made our initial landings at night, and we achieved complete surprise. The orders for the French garrison contained the statement that an approach to Courier Bay by night was impossible. Well, that's what we did. There was some heavy fighting inland, and the Royal Marines from HMS Ramillies, of course, as the historic story goes, landed from HMS Antony and created such a diversion in the naval base that the garrison surrendered and the fighting was over. And thereafter we conducted two more operations later in Majunga and Tamatave to help secure the rest of the island, but that wasn't until October, by which time the force had been briefly in Mombasa and then in Bombay, and we helped while we were in Bombay to increase the capacity of the Royal Indian Navy and our forces in India for combined operations training at Lake Karisvosla near Pune and at in Bombay itself. I was taken on board the hospital ship at Tamatave, where, curiously enough, I arrived at the same time as my military opposite number, who'd been at Majunga. He and I had both got disorders of the stomach. He had dysentery, and I had a thing called sprue, as it was subsequently diagnosed by the surgeon lieutenant commander in the hospital ship. Sprue was a complaint normally to be found in Chinese babies and old colonels, but it was fatal at one time because it was reduces your capacity to absorb any fat. And so I was very fortunate to be near South Africa, where I could have one diet which helped with this, and that was 18 bananas a day. So I was in hospital in Durban for 3 or 4 months, and then I was shipped home and found myself in the landing craft maintenance base at Port Glasgow. I was officer in charge of this base, which had two basins. We had about 200 and something craft, minor landing craft, assault craft, mechanized landing craft personnel, and I had two subsidiary storage bases, one at Dumbarton in the Hiram Walker's distillery there, and the other at Annisland in Glasgow. Two worse fire risks, it's hard to imagine, than a distillery than a sawmill's. But anyway, we managed to get through my period of command without any disasters. And I was then ordered to join Force S at Invergordon, where I became Staff Officer Operations to the commander of the support group, Force S, where we were responsible for the training and integration into the force of all the landing craft which could contribute to fire support for the landings. All the experience, and not least that of Gallipoli, has taught the importance of fire support, particularly at the last stage of landing, from the moment when the craft touches the beach and the troops run out down the ramps up to the back of the beaches of a period of the maximum casualties. We'd been taught during our beach training that the casualties were to be expected were to be very heavy indeed, and certainly there was nothing in the experience of Dieppe that detracted from that. But you have to accept that Lord Mountbatten's claim that we learnt about fire support from Dieppe is not actually true. We knew about that from our experience at Gallipoli and everything we were taught in 1941, long before Dieppe, was the importance of getting fire support right up to the time when the troops were at the back of the beach. So we had landing craft which were fitted with 4.7 inch guns. We had landing craft which were fitted with a variety of anti-aircraft weapons which could be used either against aircraft or against beach defences, Bofors guns, Ehrlichman guns. We had ships fitted with 1,000 rockets apiece, 60-pound rockets, eight to a flotilla, provided a very substantial punch. The Royal Artillery's field regiments, which were going to be carried across in LCTs, were trained to fire during the run into the beach, so that they added their quota to the firepower of the force. We had landing craft support. They were fitted with a miscellany of quick firing weapons. We had hedgehog craft, which called hedgerows, which was fitted with spigot mortars, so that they could go in very close in and actually fire their mortars, which would provide either anti-personnel injury or also could help to clear mines by countermining. So that was how we spent the autumn and winter of 1943-44. We had an exercise in February, as far as I recall, called SMASH, which was to be followed by one called GRAB. But SMASH was such a success in the sense of damage to landing craft that we didn't actually have GRAB, and there were changes in personnel made, and I found myself taken from my appointment with the support group to become the principal beachmaster of Fox Royal Naval Commando, which was to be the assault beach commando for 4th S. And so I remained at Invergordon, which is where the commando had come to. They'd been involved in Sicily, so I was going to an experienced lot. And I had to pick up the threads of my old line of business, having been principal beachmaster with the force in Madagascar. Had to learn the new tricks of the business. My army opposite number also was appointed at that time, and we did at least one exercise together, but he had an injury which put him out of action for a while, so I didn't see as much of him as I would have liked until we did our final exercises when the force had moved to the south of England. One of the things that is most striking about the Normandy campaign is the remarkable success of the detailed planning for mounting the operation before the first craft hit the beach. All the elaborate detail of moving, for example, our force, which consisted of ships and craft, and the 3rd British Infantry Division with all its impedimenta. They had been deployed in North Scotland with us, and we all had to move down to the south to camps in the Portsmouth area. And whereas you move initially as units as the plan unfolds, you have to split down into subunits and then again into craft loads, so that no craft loss is an irretrievable loss to any unit, and also that you have a proper build-up according to the landing craft strength that you have. It involves a remarkable degree of skill in selecting priorities, because everybody believes that all their people are important and must go first, but somebody has to make the decision that the craft load shall be contain a proper mix of all the elements. So for example, one craft could contain infantry with two or three Royal Engineers, perhaps two or three men from the field ambulance, perhaps an RAF man who's going to be available to help with the fuel and lubricants when they come ashore, two or three naval beach parties. So it's spread amongst eight landing craft. You have quite a substantial number of engineers, Royal Naval commandos, and people who can assist with the stores and equipment that's going to come ashore. Now, all those events had to take place with our division coming south and others moving from different directions into camps in the Portsmouth area, surrounded by barbed wire. And once in, theoretically that's where you stayed. I actually had to be out. I had to have a special pass to enable me to come and go, because I was still helping with the planning at our fourth headquarters by that time in Portsmouth. But it's a most astonishing spectacle that comes to my mind this day. Not only the hundreds and hundreds of landing craft which would have been seen at any part of the coast that you went to, but also the roads, which had been specially widened to take rows and rows of tanks and vehicles and mechanical equipment of different kinds, and the fields that were covered with piles of ammunition, discreetly camouflaged, and not only ammunition but stores of all sorts and kinds, and of course these myriad tents for the different camps. And people might move to as many as three camps, the initial one and then transit camp and then finally the camp where they're. And I always quote my own driver as an example, because he was only a very young man, and he was given a map reference and a code number, and I said goodbye to him outside Portsmouth, and I said to see you over the other side. And that's what happened, and he appeared on time, H plus 360 minutes, in Normandy, and I'd last seen him off Portsmouth, and he'd had to go all the way by himself to Dover to the map reference given and report his number, and then he'd been assigned to a craft and duly appeared at the right moment, which just is one minute detail fitting into this enormous jigsaw that had gone on. So that takes us to, we had two big exercises. One was called Fabius, and that was a logistic exercise, which we did near Littlehampton. And another one, I don't remember the title, but it simply involved us moving from our camp to a transit area on the